May it please the court. Last year, the court's en banc decision in Doe quoted from DeShaney that the 14th Amendment was enacted to protect the people from the state, not to ensure that the state protect them from each other. Make no mistake, this case is about protecting the people from the state. Unlike Doe or DeShaney, this case involves a substantive due process violation by a state actor, a police officer, who used his position to seduce and sexually assault a 15-year-old girl. Now, this case is the girl's claim that the district attorney, the sheriff, a Texas Ranger, and a Texas DPS lieutenant stood by and knowingly allowed those sexual assaults to continue, in fact, planned on them to continue, in order to make their job of prosecuting him easier. Their deliberate indifference to the repeated violation of a child's constitutional rights at the hands of another state officer is sufficient to state a claim. Below, they convinced the district court that it should dismiss this lawsuit based on the idea that we were alleging that they needed to arrest Mr. Arias sooner. The problem with that is nowhere in our complaint do we actually make that claim. In fact, our claim is the exact opposite. The claim in this case is that these officers, in their zeal to prosecute and convict, allowed and subverted our client's constitutional rights. There are two avenues of our 1983 claim. The first is that she alleges that the decision by these law enforcement officers as part of their investigation to knowingly allow Whitley to be repeatedly raped by another police officer.
Is there evidence in the record, I mean, that is affidavit or whatever from her that she was repeatedly raped?
Well, Your Honor, it's a motion to dismiss, so we haven't reached the avenue of evidence. There's claims, and they're not really disputed at all, obviously, because we're here on a motion to dismiss.
Does the complaint say repeatedly raped or just take her out?
Well, there's a complaint and an amended complaint, and the complaint, the allegations vary slightly, but yes, it's clear that she was, that it makes clear that a sexual relationship began in, the first allegations they knew of as to this officer were in January with another suspect, January 2007. It makes clear that our officer learned, the officer defendant Hannah, learned that he was grooming another victim, and that was our plaintiff, Miss Whitley, at the time he elevated her, and that other officers reported to him that they believed this was going on, and the amended complaint says specifically he knew it was going on.
July 3rd was when that was reported to him?
Well, it was actually before July 3rd. July 3rd is when the second officer, what happens is that in, and the date specific is not clear on this in the complaint, but an officer who saw them out at dinner together and believed it was inappropriate went to him and told him that she believed he was grooming another victim and that that was our plaintiff. And at that time in the amended complaint, it states that he, Officer Hannah, knew or believed that that was going on at that point. Now, that's before the sexual conduct occurs. The complaint says, though, I believe in June of 2007, I believe it's in June, that the relationship did turn sexual. Now, on July 3rd, and this is what you're referring to, Judge Davis, another officer saw them driving a vehicle. He was allowing this 15-year-old to drive his vehicle, and he followed up with Officer Hannah and told him he believed it was inappropriate and needed to be investigated. At that point, Officer Hannah, and they say they never stopped the investigation from the first instance, but they re-began the investigation and quickly discovered that there was a sexual relationship going on. Now, on July 9th, there is a meeting in the jury room with the district attorney, sheriff, Hannah, some other officers, in which it is explicitly discussed, and the amended complaint makes clear that they're told that the sexual acts are going on between this 55-year-old officer and the 15-year-old. And at that point, they develop this plan to allow it to continue to occur in order to, quote unquote, catch them in the act. And that's one part of the allegation. It's this plan that they devise at the July 9th meeting, which really is a continuation of the plan that Hannah apparently was already undergoing at least by July 3rd or 5th in order to try to get evidence directly. But the second part of the claim that gets us there for 1983 is the failure of these law enforcement officers to attempt to intercede to protect the victim from further abuse at the hands of an officer. Outside of the plan themselves, a 1983 claim can be made based on the idea that they failed to act to intercede. Now, the Supreme Court has said that you can have a 1983 action
Let me ask a question. Sure. When he was prosecuted, Reese Arias?
Yes, Your Honor.
What's the name?
Arias.
Arias. When he was prosecuted, was she called to testify?
That's not in the record, and I don't know, Your Honor. I'm sorry. He may have pled guilty, actually. So I think it may see in the record that he pled guilty.
I mean, you know, we get cases, unfortunately, a lot of cases along these lines. And there's judgment calls that the law enforcement people have to make about the victim, too, and about making the call in such a way that she won't have to testify. So there's constant judgment calls being made about how's the best way to prosecute this case. I understand your argument. I understand that all the while they're positioning the case to have it proceed a certain way, your client is continuing to be a victim of sexual assault. But it's a pretty careful judgment that's got to be made about how this thing is going to unfold when it finally does unfold. And to some extent, in some of these cases, the judgment gets made to actually spare the victim from having to be a witness in the prosecution that unfolds. So it's a very difficult.
Right. I appreciate that their job is difficult, Your Honor. And I would say that if there was a claim of negligence, if the question was when should they have acted, perhaps that sort of judgment would matter. But when the question is, do you subvert a constitutional right, then that judgment has to give way. Because you could make that same argument about the idea that it would be easier on the, in this particular case, on the rape victim, if they would have beat a confession out of the suspect. But we would never allow that, right? You can make the same argument about it would be easier to get a conviction if they illegally searched the premises to get that evidence, but we would never allow that. The question here is, were they allowed to deliberately decide to allow this child, and as they put in their brief, for the greater good, to be raped by a state actor, knowing it's a constitutional violation, because it would make it easier conviction? And that has to be a bright line rule. The Constitution cannot bow down to make it easier for them to convict, even if it means that they have to let him go in this case. That's our argument, Your Honor. Our argument is, you have to hold her constitutional right to be free from this heinous act above your duty to try to get a conviction. And that's true of all constitutional rights.
Well, doesn't the officer have to also make a judgment about whether there's anything he can do about it unless he gets some evidence that's enough to arrest him?
Right, Your Honor. And if the allegation was in this case that they did not know, or believe it was going on.
But you got to prove that. You got to be able to get a warrant to arrest somebody, and you right. got to have evidence to give a judge probable cause.
But the allegation in this case is they knew the constitutional violation was going on, and that they chose to wait to make their case better.
So now, it's not whether they can prove the case, because they actually have supervisory authority over the perpetrator. Don't they?
No, Your Honor, they don't.
Do they not have any supervisory
claim? No, it's not a supervisory claim, and that's one of the things I wanted to make clear.
Okay, that's what it's unclear.
Right.
Is the state, only deliberate indifference, and they have no supervisory authority?
No, Your Honor. Well,
could they shut down the Explorer program altogether?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe they could. It's not their program. And the argument here, and I believe it's the county officials, make the argument that DeShaney controls, and they say it's because you can't have liability because they say there's no control over Arias, who is a different department. But DeShaney, and this court already said in the Taylor ISD, which Judge Davis, you co-wrote, said that that's a serious misreading of DeShaney. DeShaney and Judge King, in your opinion, in the Covington County School District, they recognize it as well. DeShaney only applies when we're talking about a private actor. Now, here we have a police officer acting under color of state law. So we have a constitutional violation by a state actor. DeShaney doesn't come into this mix and shouldn't come into this mix. This is covered more by those cases involving deliberate indifference by the officer in their actions.
Well, what's the answer to my question, though?
Why doesn't the officer have to make a judgment about, you know, if I go in there and talk rough to this guy and tell him to leave that girl alone, is that going to be effective, or should I wait until I have enough evidence to get a warrant and go arrest him?
Well, I think the judgment has to be made not to violate the Constitution. So the same way is if he had to make the judgment, I'm going to interrogate a suspect, he has to draw that line before I begin to abuse his constitutional rights, as a suspect. If the question is whether or not you're going to do a search and seizure to get evidence, you have to make sure that you don't cross that constitutional line. In this case, if the allegation was they did not know what was going on, they had no idea what was going on, they didn't know, then perhaps that would be a valid argument. They don't make that argument, and that's not the claim that's made here. The claim that's made here is they knew she was being sexually assaulted, and they made an affirmative decision that they wanted video evidence of it. So they were going to allow it to continue to occur until they could get that video evidence.
You say they knew it, but I didn't see anywhere evidence they had that they could have gotten a warrant based on the fact that this girl was being sexually abused. They knew they suspected it. Had good grounds for suspicion, but that's not
well,
grounds for a warrant.
I think they probably could have gotten grounds on the warrant based on the text messages that the area sent to the first victim, in which he explicitly said he wanted to meet her at a hotel and have sex.
But that's somebody else. That's not this victim.
Right, but they knew at that point that he had, and the amended complaint makes clear, they say, that he had a firm conviction and believed that actually more than what he eventually was convicted from. When he was convicted, it included the counts involving the first victim, A.M., in January of 2007. So he already had enough evidence for a conviction, and he believed he did in January of 2007. Now, in June, whether or not he had enough evidence for a warrant, they have pled that he was taking, this officer was driving around late at night, parked at known makeout spots for several hours at a time with a 15-year-old girl in the middle of the night. They have several officers saying they believe that he's grooming another victim. They have the prior evidence that he had sexually assaulted another victim. I think they probably did have enough evidence for a warrant at that point. But it's sort of, and I would beg to differ, I think it's beside the point, because our whole argument is, and we think that the Constitution requires, that you let, in a particular case, perhaps a suspect go if it means that you have to protect constitutional rights.
Can you help me go through? You're only going on deliberate indifference. Are you also going on state-created danger?
We're not going on state-created danger, Your Honor. So what happened here is the district court talked about it in state-created danger and talked about it in control because it was easier for him to state the claims that way.
Okay, but you're not making a claim like in Covington, whereas this one is that hypo that was posed at oral argument in Covington, whereas if you know that the person's taking the person out of school to molest them,
and
you know that,
party. We're not making that claim.
Okay.
The way I would say, Your Honor, is we have two claims. One is the PEMBAR claim. One is this idea that they got
Why
together.
Why aren't you making that claim?
Because it's a state actor, and of course.
So you're just making a straight up deliberate indifference claim, and there's
right.
No bystander claim.
Well, the bystander claim is there too. Those are the two points. The bystander claim is separate from the Covington claim. Bystander turns on the duty, as I said, for these officers to act to stop a known constitutional violation.
Okay, so when we analyze these issues, when we go through to see if there's enough there, those are the two ways to find 1983 that we should use, deliberate indifference and the kind of sub-bystander liability.
Right, and I think those both involve deliberate indifference. I mean, I could be wrong.
Right, it's a sub under
right.
deliberate indifference,
right.
bullet bystander
so
liability.
There's the PEMBAR idea that these people, as part of their investigation, deliberately set about a course of conduct that they knew was going to result in this violation. And then there is the bystander liability, where an officer or a district attorney or anyone else has the duty to intervene in the case of watching a constitutional violation.
So you're saying the officers here had no discretion?
Right.
No discretion at all. The minute that they knew that there was sexual activity going on between this man and this 15-year-old, they had absolutely no discretion in the matter. they had to arrest him or do what it took to end the thing?
It could be that there is a defense that they have to a claim that they want to make when the facts come out. For instance, in the bystander claims, we often talk about whether or not, at what moment after the first strike, did the officer have a duty to intervene? And he could say, I didn't realize he was going to hit him again. I didn't have enough time. I wasn't close enough. There are those sort of gray areas. But in terms of pleading a claim, which I have to go back to where we're at now, the district court said that we don't even have the right in the courthouse door because, as they say, their argument, they can do anything they want in an investigation.
And when did these officers have to act? I mean, in Dole v. Taylor, the state actor who could do something about the coach molesting this young girl let it go on for months. He saw it and let it go on. So we said he ignored it. I mean, here, the investigation really focused on this case on July the 3rd, and they broke this thing up because they had the evidence on July the 17th, which, how can you say they're ignoring it when they have that active investigation going on that actually culminates in an arrest 2 weeks later?
Can I answer, Your Honor?
Yeah.
I'm not saying that they're ignoring it. What I'm saying is that they deliberately chose to allow this victim to be raped by a 55-year-old officer in order to get his conviction. And that is the height of deliberate indifference. They made a conscious decision, which is no different than if they stood by and watched someone be beaten or watched someone be raped, watched somebody be their premises be illegally searched. They decided, as a course of conduct, the allegation is, in their investigation, for a constitutional violation to occur. And if the courts aren't open to that, then we've abrogated our duty to review and protect people from constitutional violations from police officers. Thank you.
Mr. DeAndrea.
May it please the court. Plaintiff's argument today conflates two very different constitutional claims. No one disputes that plaintiff has a constitutional right to not be sexually assaulted under the color of law. Plaintiff has already sued on that claim and has already won a significant judgment. Here, she urges a different sort of constitutional claim. She asks this court to recognize a substantive due process right to have police intervene at a certain point in time to protect her from a criminal suspect. That sort of claim, and beyond that, she asks you to recognize that that claim has been clearly established. That sort of claim would work mischief for law enforcement and the courts, and it is squarely foreclosed by the Supreme Court's decision in Castle Rock.
Is that the same thing as saying they have no duty to keep her from being bait? There's a difference between standing by and doing nothing versus purposefully setting into motion things that will make her be bait, aren't there?
There is, Your Honor, but the complaint here does not allege that they set anything in motion. This is purely a they stood by and waited sort of case. Now, I could imagine a case where I went and hired someone to say, you know, you look exactly, you fit the profile of someone they would want to abuse. I'm going to hire you to mow my lawn, and they're going to come by and abuse you, and we're going to videotape it. So there they actually set it in motion. That is a state-created danger case. I think is the best way that would be framed, and as we know in the circuit, it's not recognized. The court below found that this is not a state-created danger sort of case because, as the district court found, they didn't plead that they used their authority to create an opportunity that would not have otherwise existed, absent the third party's conduct.
Well, actually, state-created danger has not been foreclosed in this circuit, so that's not actually true. Covington did not foreclose state-created danger, just said it didn't meet this test if we were to have it.
That's right, Your Honor. So I suppose my
that's
point
not,
is that—
neither here nor there, because he says he's not relying on that.
But to win this case, that's right, but to win this case, they have to find clearly established law.
Well, they don't have to find clearly established law right now. We're just on, do they state a claim?
Yeah, but it was dismissed for qualified immunity grounds too, right?
Also, so on the back end, we do have to do that.
So you're right, Your Honor. You could hold that this is the case where we are going to find a state-created danger theory, but because it wasn't clearly established at the time, we affirm and dismiss.
But he doesn't want us to anyway.
Right. That's right. And I would urge the court to look at. I think qualified immunity is the right way to approach these cases. As Judge Kagan said last term, the court should think hard and think hard again before it turns easy cases into hard ones. by jumping to the constitutional question instead of just sweeping it aside on qualified immunity grounds. And Castle Rock is the decision that establishes that. Castle Rock holds that there is no substantive due process right to police protection. For her lawsuit to succeed, she needs clearly established law to the contrary, and she turns to the bystander liability cases, like Ware v. Reed and Hale v. Townley. But those cases are about police officers who stood by and laughed while their partners summarily punished a criminal suspect. As Judge Brown put it in Ware v. Reed, those are cases where the defendants acquiesce in the unconstitutional conduct of other officers.
Well, aren't you acquiescing if you are doing nothing when the police car is parked at the known parking spot and you're not going over there and finding your fellow and saying, hey, what are you doing here?
You're not acquiescing if your entire purpose is to put an end to it and get Arias off the street. Everything he did was aimed at getting Arias off the street. That's not acquiescence. Now, I suppose if you were watching the videos and then selling them on the internet, that would start to transform this into acquiescence. But as long as you're in your investigative...
So are you saying that it's okay to violate someone's right as long as you have a noble purpose?
I'm saying there's no constitutional right here. That's what Castle Rock holds. That was a 12B6 case.
I thought you said there was a constitutional right to be free from the bodily integrity.
Absolutely.
Claim is a constitutional
right. There was, and that was the city policeman, Arias, and the city of Brownwood, which has already been sued and already lost, as they should have already been sued and already lost. We are a state entity that came in to investigate them and put an end to what was going on. There was no acquiescence at any sort. And I think
when were the parents notified on this record that is before us?
Your Honor, it's not clear. That's right. So this is their point, is we didn't want him arrested. We just wanted to do something, right? But it's not clear what Ranger Hanna could have done short of arrest, except maybe corner the guy in the hall or notify the parents. And I think the concern was, none of this is in the record, but what exactly can parents do, right? What would this have done other than drive this abusive relationship further underground, make it impossible for him to stop? Or the alternative, they could have run him out of town like we might have done 50 years ago for him to terrorize some other community. So it's not clear to me that that would have made any difference. And I think the best thing they could have done for her and the community is get Arias off the street. And the best way to protect her is to put him in prison, not to just scare him and let him know
even
the cops are on his trail.
Even if it means she has to be subjected to multiple rapes in the meantime?
They didn't know that, Your Honor. The complaint
but they didn't
most
know
alleged-
it wasn't.
That's right. I mean,
they knew it was a sexual relationship.
They suspected it was a sexual relationship, and it was a core executive discretionary function. I mean, that's what Castle Rock holds, is that this is the kind of thing Castle Rock is a much harder case. Let's take that. There was a court order, a TRO, that said, leave the mom and the children alone. She calls the police. My husband came by at 5 o'clock. He kidnapped my children out of the front yard. There's a TRO that says you must arrest him. He's violating that court order. The police say, call back at 10. She calls back at 7. I texted him. I know where he is. He's at an amusement park. He has my kids. Please go get them. They say, call back at 10. She calls back at 10. They say, call back at 12. She goes down to the station at 12:30. They finally let her file a police report. The officer takes the report and then says, I'm going to dinner. And he goes to dinner. The next morning, they find the children dead. It is a much harder case, right? There, Castle Rock, the Supreme Court holds, you have no substantive due process right to police protection on demand. This is an easier case because here they didn't even demand it. Here it was
but
just
it's police protection from police in this case. And
the closest case on point are the two bystander liability cases, and I think they're pretty far off. I think they're far off because what Castle Rock is talking about is where the core of executive discretion is when you're talking about arrest, the timing of arrest, the investigating function. And if the complaint pleads themselves out of court because they plead that this was all about the investigative function and all about arrest. And as long as you're talking about that, this isn't you watching other officers abuse someone. This is the core of Castle Rock discretionary function. And it's got to be this way because this is the sort of law that we all agree needs to be enforced vigorously. But when administrations change, enforcement priorities change along with them. And this is a well-known feature of the way it works, right? And as you know, there are tons of federal criminal statutes, and no U.S. attorney could enforce them all.
Are there guidelines regarding minors and sexual abuse situations and notice to the parents, et cetera?
There are none in the record about how the Texas Rangers do that, Your Honor.
The Texas Rangers, that they have some duty to tell the parents as soon as they become aware of molestation of the child or report it to CPS for an investigation or something like that? Isn't there some guideline that would say that?
I would imagine there are. I don't know them. They're not in the record. I don't think there is no evidence that, I mean, Ranger Hanna was not punished for this. He was commended for it.
But,
I mean,
don't think if they didn't do that and that...
I don't see why that's... That's right. Then he would be fired and maybe state some kind of state tort law. But I don't see why that's a matter of substantive due process.
Right, and they brought state tort claims, and then they... I'm going to ask about that. What... You know, it's supposed to be freely given, and they were not given leave. And right. Do you have a comment on that?
Yes, they weren't given leave for two reasons. The first is the way they pleaded those state forms, those state tort claims, they would be dismissed. The more important reason is if the district court threw out their only federal claims, as I think this court should do, and then it's a matter of pendant jurisdiction. And that is also a matter, I mean, that's clearly a matter of district court discretion. At 12b-6, if you throw out the only federal claims, at 12b-6, why would you
open... Well, you should be dismissing them as without prejudice, then.
The State Tort Claims Act?
Yeah. The State Tort Claims should be dismissed without prejudice. If you're going to pendant, then instead of with prejudice.
That's right. So they could refile in state court. So I suppose... But I would assure the court that these sort of take... The question under the Texas Tort Claims Act is, was the officer acting generally in the scope of his employment? And if he was... then the plaintiff has to substitute in the state. And at that point, you have a lawsuit against the state, eo nomine, right? So there are two outcomes of that. The first is the Texas Tort Claims Act does not waive sovereign immunity, and so it doesn't belong in federal court. And the second is the Texas Tort Claims Act does not waive immunity for these sort of conspiracy to sexual assault claims that they have brought. So there's no way these Texas Tort Claims Act claims would have proceeded, just as I think the same result would attend in federal court. If you tried to sue a federal officer under the Federal Tort Claims Act for this sort of conspiracy to sexual assault, I don't think those are waived either.
Is there a limit here? If they were standing by and they were waiting for someone to go get the video camera because it wasn't working on someone's patrol car or something, and they have to go get one at the office, and so there's an officer standing by physically observing with his eyes the assault, can he stand there because he says, it'll be much better if I get it on tape and we don't have to rely on my testimony because I have some bad issues and my credibility is going to be challenged and I want eyewitness testimony.
I think that's a horrendous fact pattern. That officer would be fired, but no, there's no... Under Castle Rock, they knew.
So even under that circumstance, you could say, I'm going to go get the video camera.
You can say, I'm going to dinner.
Is there a point beyond which you're not going to wait anymore?
The point at which it becomes acquiescence, I think then it falls under...
Well, if you're standing there right next to the guy raping the person...
But you're investigating. As long as the complaint pleads you out of court if you say you were standing there watching because you wanted more or better evidence. If you say, and then that's what their complaint says. If the complaint pleads, you stood there and watched for some illicit reason, not related to prosecuting the case, then it's different. Then it's acquiescence. The problem here is the complaint admits that this was all about the investigative function. And as long as that's what the complaint says, he stood by and watched because he thought, I have a bad vision and I need a camera, then yes, that does not state a claim for substantive due process. And again, Castle Rock is that claim. There the officers knew. They knew where they were. The TRO said, you must arrest this guy if he breaks it. And the TRO also told him, don't go near the children. They knew he had the children, they knew where he was, and they went to dinner.
And it doesn't matter that it's law enforcement is the perpetrator.
No.
It doesn't put an extra layer of...
I don't see how it could. Because imagine, if it did, it would be impossible for police to investigate and punish their own. Worse than that, it would be impossible for police to investigate and punish any state actor. Because you could always play this game that the underlying tortfeasor was a state actor. So even if it's just some HHSC official, we can't bring in Texas Rangers to investigate them, or that should not change the calculus. And I would add one final thing. Nowhere in their brief do plaintiffs say exactly when Ranger Hanna should have stepped in. So even plaintiffs can't articulate the contours of the clearly established right they seek to enforce. You see these qualified immunity claims in all sorts of cases, right? We get them on behalf of people who have desk jobs, of professors, of engineers at TxDOT. This is the core of qualified immunity. This is to ensure that a police officer in an ambiguous situation can vigorously exercise his duty to protect the public without looking over his shoulder at a lawsuit.
Okay, so you believe this is right in the core, and you don't think these officers were in any way out of line?
I think this is an easier case than Castle Rock. I don't think they're out of line at all, Your Honor.
Okay.
I think this was a very hard decision they had to make. I think it was an ambiguous situation. And I think there's nothing they could have done, as Judge Davis pointed out, short of arrest and getting this guy off the street. This was the best thing they could have done to protect the plaintiff.
Well, there are a number of other things they could have done, but we've time is up.
All right. Mr. Hogg?
May it please the court. My name is John Mark Hogue, and I represent District Attorney Michael Murray and Sheriff Grubbs of Brown County in this case. There is not a lot that, in addition to my brief, that I think I need to relate to the court other than answering any other questions the court may have. I would like to address the supervisor authority and the control issue, because that's the main part of our case, of our contention in this case, is we do not cite DeShaney saying DeShaney is controlling. We understand that it's a private actor case, but we think DeShaney is instructive, and we think it's the Supreme Court decision from which we draw the conclusions that this court has drawn in several cases before. The issue of control over the perpetrator as being the one for whom that constitutional duty is placed upon, both in the Taylor case and in the Raines case.
What control did you have?
We didn't have any control, Your Honor. The control in this situation would have been in the prior case with the police department, with the Explorer program, with the city of Brownwood, and that case has already been decided. This case was the district attorney and the sheriff. The only allegations in the complaint are that when Ranger Hanna asked to have a meeting with the district attorney and other law enforcement officials, because this is an internal investigation, at that point had the discussion about the circumstances regarding the investigation. Now, that's all in allegations. The allegations really amount to they had this meeting and the district attorney and the sheriff endorsed this plan, and that's essentially what the allegations are related to that.
So you have no control over this officer, even through an official challenge in the city, the way the sheriff and the DA and
not in the way
talk
our
to the police department chief and
not in the way our decentralized system works. I mean, I suppose yes, if they had chosen to, they could have said, "We'll pick up the phone and we'll call the chief." Of course, the chief was already involved at that point because I believe, as the allegations go, the case originally came to Ranger Hanna through the Detective Weatherman of the Brownwood Police Department. When the original case came back with the AM victim who had been, that's how the case got to the Rangers in the first place. But other than picking up the phone and saying, what do we need to do? Is this the right decision to make? Is that the way to do? They have no control over him. He's not an employee of the District Attorney's Office. He's not an employee of the Brown County Sheriff's Department. The whole point of decentralized government is we have no control over that officer, over the Explorer program, over anything. The only control, the only right that the district attorney has is as the prosecutor, and all the only right that the sheriff has is as a law enforcement officer. So their opportunity of control at that point is, do we have enough to arrest the individual for it, and do we have enough to prosecute this individual for these offenses? And so we contend that that's the real key issue, and we think that this court's jurisprudence shows that the key issue in all these cases, when you're getting not just the allegations of the liability of the perpetrator, but of those over him, the supervisory authority, that it comes down to an issue of control. And without that control, there's no constitutional duty to impose that upon the district.
But the sheriff could have arrested him, too.
Assuming there was evidence for probable cause and to get a warrant, yes, the sheriff could have arrested him.
Wasn't what was disclosed at the meeting enough evidence for probable cause to get a warrant?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because I believe the allegations in the complaint essentially are of circumstances of suspicions, but not of anything that would rise to the level to be able to get a warrant for probable cause.
I thought the complaint says they knew as of the meeting date.
Well, that's the allegation.
And that's what we have to take
as
true.
But the facts on which that allegation is based, once you go back and look at the prior ones, all relates to the prior complainant, essentially. And I think, if I remember right, the allegations of someone saw him at dinner and that was suspicious, and so he went and talked to the ranger, and that's what got the investigation going again, and some surveillance circumstances of a car parked in certain locations. Is that enough evidence? I guess that's the question. Is that enough evidence to impose upon these officers the duty to go arrest him right then, regardless of their discretion as far as what happens with the case once they make that arrest? Can they even get an indictment from a grand jury? Can they make those charges stick? And, you know, the plaintiff's position in this case is, I think, a bad policy choice for this court to go down, because what you're essentially saying is, we're going to, in all circumstances, put the right of the alleged victim over the conviction, over the right of the state to prosecute and stop the crime.
Why is that a bad policy choice, to put the rights of children to have bodily integrity over, it doesn't matter whether some guilty people go free as long as you protect children and their bodily integrity? That would be a perfectly fine civil policy choice.
It would be very simple.
There's nothing wrong with that policy choice. It's not a less paramount value than law enforcement.
Well, I would disagree with that, Your Honor. I think that's where the discretion of the officers comes into play, and the discretion of the government in prosecuting and investigating those cases is paramount, because those are very hard decisions to make, very hard decisions for law enforcement.
Right, but
to
you
make.
Said that you shouldn't put children above. And I'm saying you very well could say in your society that we're going to put children's safety above everything else.
You certainly could. You certainly could make that choice, Your Honor.
So I know that you believe that your officers would be they'd be entitled to qualified immunity in any event, but do you agree with your colleague that they did nothing wrong?
I agree.
That they didn't make any poor decisions?
As far as my clients go, Your Honor, I'm not going to offer any judgments related to anyone else, but the district attorney, Murray, and the sheriff, the only allegations are this meeting. And the only allegation is that they were advised of the circumstances of the investigation. And the allegation is, you know, they approved. And, of course, we have issues with the case about whether those state sufficient facts under Iqbal as far as the kind of language used in Dorsey.
Right, but you think it was the proper
thing? We think it was the proper thing to for them to do under
those
circumstances.
And they shouldn't have gone to the paper or said that the Explorer program should be shut down, or gone call up their buddy the sheriff and gotten this all wiped out, and called the parents in the community and said, we're going to have a meeting, and if you have any things where your people have been exposed, let us know. Notified everybody or gotten CPS, you think that they behaved exactly appropriately?
I think those are circumstances, those are events that can occur, and which in fact did occur after the event. They have to, their obligation is the prosecutor and the chief law enforcement officer of the county is to make sure the laws of the state of Texas are prosecuted, and they fulfill that obligation. That, I believe, that is their primary duty. Beyond that, I think those are other things that did occur. But I think they acted appropriately in responding to the circumstances that were presented to them.
Wouldn't it be protect would be the first obligation?
Well, yes, of course, Your Honor, but that is part of the duty. That is part of the duty, Your Honor. Good point. The only other thing I would add in conclusion is going back and just addressing the issue related to the Pembauer that was addressed by plaintiff's counsel, by appellant's counsel. In that case, we're talking about an issue that the issue in that case was whether or not the prosecutor could be held as a delegation as a policymaker under Section 1983, and we think that really is not a relevant distinction in this case. What we're talking about here comes back just to the issue of control, and we think that's the primary issue the court should be looking at. Unless there are other further questions, that's all
Thank
I have.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Kuhn.
If you separate our claims from the facts we actually allege and the case law from what the court's already said, it's easy to get rid of our case. But that's what they're trying to do here. They're trying to say repeatedly Castle Rock, this duty to arrest. Castle Rock has absolutely nothing to do with this case. It was a private party. It was more like DeShaney. They didn't intercede. They didn't know. There's no allegation they knew that this actual harm was taking place at the time. And they said, you don't have a duty, as we said in DeShaney, to be protected by the state from a private party. That's not this case, right? This case, and again, let me say, we're here on a motion to dismiss. You have to take these facts as alleged, you know, in a light more favorable to the claims that are made. And here we specifically say they knew this was going on. Repeatedly we say they knew it was going on, and they knew and intended for it to go on.
Yeah, but you can't rely on a conclusory allegation. You got to have facts to back
that's right, Your Honor.
That up.
And they do have a numerous facts, and he added facts in the amended complaint to say, for instance, they have video coverage of him fondling her and kissing her in the hallway and taking his belt off after they go into the room for 30 minutes at a time in the middle of the night, 2 a.m. in the morning. I mean, they have all these factual specific complaints. Read the amended complaint. It's outrageous what they did in this case. And they did it deliberately. And he stands here and tells you, and of course, when you press him on it, Judge Elrod, he backs off and says, well, we don't know. So, I mean, no. Well, that's the allegation, is that they knew. And we pled specific facts to show that they knew, and they are stuck with those allegations. If they want to come back on summary judgment and show we did everything by the book, this is the way you want law enforcement to work, they can have that right, but you can't pour us out at this point on the idea that this isn't a claim. Go back to what he says up here when he talks about it, right? When he says we have an absolute right for the greater good to do whatever we want in investigatory capacity. That's exactly opposite what the Supreme Court has said. They have immunity as prosecutors in the courtroom. They don't have immunity in their investigatory process. They don't have immunity as police officers where they're watching another police officer assault a victim. They're trying to set the clock back 50 years. PEMBAR was about breaking down a door. It was about breaking down a door, and the court said you can go after that district attorney for that individual policy decision to say, go ahead, you have the right to break down the door when the law said you don't. Here we have a molestation, a rape of a 15-year-old child by a 55-year-old officer, and they stood by and they knew it was happening. They intended it to happen. They wanted it to happen to make their prosecution. That 15-year-old child's constitutional rights are just as protectable as that door. The other cases we talk about the cases where you stand by and watch a partner assault one, and they get up here and say, well, Hale, Your Honor, those cases, yeah, they're distinguishable because that's the same partner. No, it's not. Read Hale. There's a head note that says it doesn't have to be from the same force. Hale was a deputy sheriff from Cato County and a Shreveport police officer. They weren't from the same force. And this idea they had to be present, they talk about. They don't have to be present. This court in United States versus McKinsey, and this isn't in the brief, but 768 F. 2nd 608, in 1985, was looking at a case out of New Orleans that dealt with abuse by New Orleans police officers to try to get interrogation. And it had to do with a criminal conviction for civil rights violations, for allowing that to happen, also for not stopping it. And one of those defendants, it talked about how he was not, there was no evidence he was in the interrogation room when these, or he didn't take place in any of it. But what the court said was that there was evidence that he admitted he was in and out of the room while Davis was being interrogated. And that's sufficient to support the conclusion he was aware of what was transpiring and did not stop it. The law is well established that a law enforcement officer who makes no attempt to intercede, it doesn't say convict, doesn't say charge, doesn't say arrest, no attempt to intercede to prevent another state actor from committing a violation is just as guilty of that same violation. And if I can, just quickly, to borrow from the court's ISD, Taylor ISD claim, on this qualified immunity, and I believe it was Judge Elrod, your question you made, Grubbs and the sheriff and the district attorney, they didn't allege qualified immunity in this case. They didn't argue it in their motion. The other side did. But in terms of qualified immunity, you put a nail in the head in Taylor ISD when you said the question is whether, and this borrows from it, in 2007, a reasonable law enforcement officer would have assumed that they could, with constitutional impunity, stand by and let another police officer sexually assault a child. In 2007, and we lay it on our brief, we have more of a quarter of a century of case law that says there's no way that that was not reasonably clear at the time. It may have cost you your conviction. The Constitution is more important than the conviction. And that's our claim in this case.
Thank you. The court will be in recess for a few minutes.